Okay, I know he's still in my docking. Good evening. My name is Brenda Gale Fox, and my presentation is, what is the history of federal legislation for First Nations education in Canada? Industrial schools and reformatory schools, I'm looking at the period of 1840s to the early 1900s. The industrial period was a time when the factory system emerged. Parents working and children were left to wander in the streets unattended. Victorian middle-class reformers had the conviction that education could reduce crime if accompanied by moral indoctrination and hard work. And these were middle-class standards. Britain, Canada, and the United States followed this social intervention that Jack Stasiewicz called the policing of families. Common schools appeared. Youngsters were brought under adult supervision. New institutions, orphanages, reformatories, and industrial schools held children in custody. Industrial and reformatory school inmates were confined against their wills and subjected to routines that combined academic and moral instruction with work training. Residential and industrial schools were used as instruments of control. They were useful for an emergent capitalistic order designed to repress and control uncontrollable members of the working class. As such, new mechanisms were needed for economic and social relation. They became a means of repression in order to legitimize the new social structures. Various populations had to be identified, isolated, then marginalized. Research in the history of education focusing on the specific case of Britain has increasingly acknowledged the interaction between education qua domestic social policy and the outward visage of nation states and empires, which was taken from Goodman. Further to this point, Goodman adds, most of the school systems, institutions, and educational practices that are discussed are mainly a result of European or Western economic missionary and imperial activity in the countries that were under the British rule. Residential and industrial schools continued. In short, nation states with imperial ambitions needed to control and marginalize indigenous cultures and facilitate the Western education of all First Nations people. It is important to note that First Nations people did not have any say in the school systems the government and churches arbitrarily used to marginalize and assimilate First Nations students into mainstream society. First Nations industrial schools, the institutional solution, looking at 1840s through 1920s. The institutional solution arising during the industrial age was to confine children who had social problems into specialized institutions. Canada and the United States renamed reformatory industrial schools, and in the 20th century, they became training schools. The schools provided a secure network for missionaries from evangelical traditions, and evangelicals emphasized the redemptive power of religion rather than structured social conditions as the key to educational change. Work elements in schools, whether agricultural, industrial, or domestic in nature, was one of the keys to character reformation. Youth were kept busy, free from the vice of idleness, and they trained youth for lives they felt these children should lead. Stockholm in 1878, International Penitentiary Committee, resolved that delinquent youth be educated to gain an honest livelihood and to become of use to society. Character reformation therefore became a great project of reformatory and industrial schooling. It was assumed that young inmates could be trained to become respectable citizens. How were the First Nations schools structured to marginalize and assimilate First Nations students? The First Nations school systems that will be discussed are the residential schools, industrial schools, and the integration of First Nations students into the public school systems. The residential and industrial schools experiment tried to regulate social and moral behaviors but ended up marginalizing students. Rather than being a First Nations school, They represented a symbolic reaffirmation of the sanctity of traditional Western institutions. What is the history of federal legislation for First Nations education in Canada? So let's just look at a brief timeline here. So we're looking at the BNA Act of 1867, which was the first initiative to take control of First Nations education in Canada. Then there was the Indian Act, 1876, which set up the rules and regulations governing First Nations education. Then there was Treaty 7 in 1877, which set up the rules and regulations of First Nations education in southern Alberta. Then the Constitutional Act of 1982, which officially transferred control to the Canadian government from Britain. And I think it's important to note here that it so happened that I was living in the town of St. Paul, Alberta, when the people from the Cree reservations were very upset. St. Paul had just received a brand new school because at that time all of the monies that were allocated for First Nations were being allocated to the different surrounding towns, cities that were close to the reserve. So it was those communities that were benefiting from the money that was meant for First Nations students. So St. Paul took all the money that was available to the Northern Reserves, which included the Cree, the Slavey, the Chipewyan, and took all of their money and built this great brand new school. But they weren't happy there. They did not get along there. So what the parents did at that time is they made a stand, and it was mainly the mothers. St. Paul, Alberta was very, very cold. The weather was minus 50 for days on end. And these mothers stood at the edge of the reserve and they would not let the buses come in and pick up their kids. So this went on for quite a while, and then eventually John Cretchen, who was the head of the Indian Affairs at that time, finally came to meet with the leaders, and it was shortly after that that they ended up with having their own band-controlled schools where the funds were now going to the reserve schools where it was intended and not going into the public schools where the students weren't very successful. Then the First Nation Control of Education of 1972, that's when the First Nations were given the mandate to administer and run their own schools, but were still under the control of the Aboriginal Affairs. Two primary objectives of the residential school system: to remove and isolate children from the influence of their homes, families, traditions, and cultures, and to marginalize and assimilate them into the dominant culture. 132 federally supported schools were located in every province and territory except for Newfoundland, New Brunswick, and Prince Edward Island. Schools were operated as joint ventures with Anglican, Catholic, Presbyterian, or United Churches. The residential school continued. Very young children were often forcibly removed from their homes. Children were deprived of the care and nurturing of their parents, grandparents, and communities. Just think, if you were in this particular situation and you had no say and your children were taken away from you and you absolutely had no idea when they would be returning or if you would ever see them again. First Nation students were forbidden from speaking their language or practicing their cultures in these schools. The history, unfortunately for a lot of us that have gone to school, in our history in Canada, even though First Nations is a very big part of our history, it's been totally left out. And it wasn't until I went to university that I even became aware of Duncan Campbell Scott, who I learned, it really, really bothered me when I found out like how he felt, and just thinking of those people that were in power at that time. But what Scott was the head of the Department of Indian Affairs from 1913 to 1932. A department he had served since joining the federal civil service in 1879. Even before Confederation, the Canadian government adopted a policy of assimilation. In 1920, under Scott's direction, it became mandatory for all Native children between the ages of 7 and 15 to attend one of Canada's residential schools. I want to get rid of the Indian problem. I do not think it's a matter of fact that the country ought to continuously protect a class of people who are able to stand alone. Our objective is to continue until there is not a single Indian in Canada that has not been absorbed into the body politic, and there is no Indian question and no Indian department. That is the whole objective of this bill. Duncan Campbell Scott. The children who attended these schools lived in terrible conditions. In some cases, the mortality rate exceeded 50% due to the spread of infectious diseases alone. The children were taken away from their homes, their families, their culture. In some cases, they were physically, mentally, and sexually abused. Actions tolerated in the drive to achieve the objective quoted above. The government policy was kill the Indian in the child. There's a video clip here that I wanted to show, but we're running into a little bit of problems with technology, but we'll be showing that after the break. Canada forcibly removed around 150,000 Indian children from their families and communities, beginning in the late 19th century until the late 1970s. The children were sent to government-funded residential schools run by Christian churches. The purpose of residential schools was to kill the Indian and the child, and thereby forcibly integrate Indian children into settler Canadian society. First Nations Industrial School. This is the school that was called the Dumbo School, or St. Joseph's Industrial School. My grandfather, the late Senator Jim Gladstone, went to this school, Dumbo, and he was able to learn trades, some of which was useful, like his ranching and that. He learned to work the printing press, but that there's no jobs on the reserve. So even though they had some training, there was nothing that they could really do with it because they didn't have the resources or the money to be able to initiate those economic projects. History of industrial schools. The industrial schools are naturally residential schools. The pupils are fed and clothed, and in addition to instruction in the ordinary branches of an English primary education, the boys are trained in gardening, care of animals, primitive farming, and odd jobs. In the industrial schools, technical education is more advanced, and boys are also trained in carpentry, shoemaking, blacksmith's work, etc. Girls are taught housewifery, tidiness and neatness, personal cleanliness, cooking, washing, and dressmaking. And bowing down to the males. No, I'm just kidding. The industrial school graduates were generally helped by the Department of Indian Affairs when they returned to the reservation. Such help took the form of a loan of horses, oxen, and a few agricultural implements. Often, boys settled on the land and were considered to be good and useful citizens. Suppliers of domestic servants. Students were placed out. Boys and girls are placed out with little, if any, say in the matter. Major suppliers of domestic servants. The schools became major suppliers of domestic servants well into the 20th century. And I just want to share a story that I found out. My grandfather from Siksika, his name was Manigapi. Manigapi Matayapitpoy. So my grandfather never spoke English. And here his children were taken away from him and placed into Olsan Residential School. And he was wondering where his children were, and he was concerned about them, and he was trying to find out where they were at. He discovered that his second youngest son, my Uncle Roy, had been sent to New York City to train to become a minister. And at the same time, he discovered that my mother, Aileen Gladstone, was in the process of being sent to England because she was such a good housekeeper enough that they wanted to, there was a family in England that wanted to take her in. So my grandfather was very desperate in trying to ensure that his kids were brought back home and that they weren't taken away. So there was an attitude of subservience. Boys working in fields, girls taught domestic service. Integration practices in education. Whose idea was this? When I did my research, I noticed that there was a lot of research on residential schools and there was a lot of research on industrial schools, but there wasn't a lot of research done on integration. Integration system was where they wanted to take the First Nations students and they put them into public schools. So what they would do is they would take them into the cities or into the towns and they would be put to live with other non-Native families. And then they would go to school, and then on the weekend they'd be able to return back to their families. in some cases, some of them weren't able to go home that often. Integration practices in education. The integration educational system, as described by Verna Kurtness, states, the integration concept was a continuation of government control over the lives of Indian people. It was introduced with little or no consultation with Indian parents, Indian bands, or Indian organizations. No particular preparation of teachers or of curriculum was made to accommodate the children of another culture. In the words of Chief Dan George, in a talk to teachers, he comments on integration. You talk big words of integration in the schools. Does it really exist? Can we talk of integration until it is only social integration? Unless there is integration of hearts and minds, you have only a physical presence, and the walls are as high as the mountain range. Integration practices. Integration has been in most schools only a physical presence. This approach to education has not been one of true integration, where the Indian cultures are respected and recognized. Rather, it has been a process of assimilation where Indians are being absorbed into the non-native society. The entire process has a colonist agenda. Such a focus necessitated the marginalization and assimilation of First Nation children. In the case of Aboriginal mothers, stories of government involvement in family life often go back generations. The legacy of removing children from their families and communities, first through the residential schools, industrial schools, integration system, and today through the child protection system, continues to impact the lives of these mothers, their children, and their grandchildren. What's the real reason for the proposed changes in the new First Nations Education Act? Okay, this is my point of view. Franklin concludes that schooling is a mechanism of social control. Education in general and the everyday meanings of the curriculum in schools in particular can be seen as essential elements of the existing social privilege, interest, and knowledge of one element of the population at the expense of the less powerful groups. The experiences of First Nation children with Western education show that as a means of social control, the schools have failed them. First Nation control of education on reserves. Just recently, just in the last 6 weeks, the Blood Tribe has had the opportunity of having Paul Martin come there to work with the youth with try and build up some entrepreneur businesses with them. And then we also had, this is our AFN leader at Leo. He was there when Harper came to discuss the First Nation, some of the initial negotiations that are currently taking place right now. And I teach at Upsaki Elementary School. I've been teaching there for 7 years. Our staff there's only one Native member at our school that is on. The rest of the staff are all First Nation people from the Blood Reserve. There's some from Begani, and there's one from Tutsina. And this is my class, this year's class. I have 15 students in my class. So the current initiative of teaching Blackfoot language and culture, and I had a video clip here that I wanted to show, but again, I will show that after a break. And I just wanted to talk about Shannon Kustachin's dream. The children of Athabasca became the face of a generation of forgotten First Nation reserve children, and Shannon became their voice. She had moxie. She challenged government ministers and spoke at rallies and youth conferences. At 14, she was nominated for the International Children's Peace Prize. In December 2009, the government finally agreed to build a school. What was happening was they had a school on the reserve, but it was under poor condition. They had problems with water and all kinds of structural problems with the school, lack of funding, and they kept lobbying the government, the current Indian agent, to come out and take a look at it and correct it, but nothing was happening. And in grade 9, Shannon left her flying community to attend a non-Indian high school in New Lizard, Ontario. It broke her heart to leave home, but she believed that young leaders had to become fully educated. Shannon maintained a deep connection to her Cree language and culture. She was thrilled when her high school asked her to be the lead dancer in their annual powwow. She never got the chance. Just days before, she was killed in a car accident, along with her mentor and friend, Rose Thornton. Conclusions. Reformatories and industrial schools were instruments of an emergent capitalistic order to repress and control uncontrollable members of the working class. The reform surrounding the institutions was a pretense that the motives were humane and progressive. Ideals had nothing to do with it. New mechanisms for regulating economic and social relations were needed. A means of repression to legitimize the new moneyed ruling order and to whip into line various marginal populations. The schools were punitive institutions which imposed restraint and control on the bodies and minds of the inmates. The reformatory and industrial school movement was more than a massive experiment in social and moral regulation. It represented as well as a symbolic reaffirmation of the sanctity of traditional institutions, the nuclear family, the rural community, women's domesticity, and the Christian church. This is the historical legacy of First Nations education legislation in Canada. For the new proposed First Nations Education Act, these historical realities need to be acknowledged and never repeated again in Canada. One way of ensuring this is to explicitly focus on a balanced approach to First Nations education across Canada.